Good morning, everyone. I'm going to talk about the utility of a geochemical normalization method, and particularly at the scale of landscapes, and where we are primarily interested in interactions between the land surface or soils and the atmosphere. So I'm a pathologist, so my primary interest is knowing how soils form as they are, and how do we have soils variability in space and time as a result of myriad of processes that could be classified into those four groups. But when we do that, we look at those transport processes through the windows of the elements. So by measuring the elemental concentrations, that we know how much of them are available, are present in the soils, and also those elemental concentrations provide kind of the first top-down control on their availability for nutrient demand for plants, and also on the ecological and geochemical processes. But those elemental abundances or their concentrations are often misreading, and because we can kind of take the analogy of some kind of dish that you are going to finish for your dinner. So even if you claim that you like all of the vegetables, there could be one vegetable you kind of less like. For example, let's say you kind of less like potatoes. So as you finish your dish, then you know that you are also consuming potatoes, but then their concentrations will actually increase because you are preferentially eating out other things. So the concentrations don't necessarily tell you about the processes that are involved in the kind of soil formation, in this case, your present dish. So how do you correct that? And one way to do it is to normalize the concentration of potatoes for, let's say, one of the vegetables that you never even touch. Let's say there are green onions here that you may not touch, touch even at all. Then you can normalize the concentration of potatoes to the concentration of green onions, then you can begin to talk about how much potatoes you actually have eaten, even though its concentration is increasing over the time. So that's basically what we do when we normalize elemental concentrations for zirconium or niobium and titanium, depending on your system, to understand how much metal loss you had during the conversion of a bedrock or parent material into the soils. You can basically quantify the absolute mass of the elements that you have lost during the soil formation, or you can also choose to do kind of fraction of the original element that have been lost or gained during the soil formation. So this is essentially an inverse modeling approach. You have a mass balance, and you measure all those variables you can. Then those once those measurements are constrained by the mass balance, you can estimate the fractional mass losses relative to their original mass. So if you have tau of calcium, for example, zero, then it means that all the calcium in the parent material has been conserved during the soil formation. But if you have negative values, that means that you have lost some portion of calcium during the soil formation. Or if you have positive values, that means that calcium has been added into the soil from the external sources. So this approach has been really widely applied to understand the the soil forming processes in a wide range of settings. But primarily, this approach has been particularly productive in understanding soils as a function of time, so how soils form over the time, or soils as a function of a climate, or soils as a function of a parent material. And all those processes that lead to the soils we have occur over the long time, long-term scale. So and then that's the kind of time scale where geochemical normalization method has been particularly useful. But I'm going to show you several examples that this geochemical normalization method can be also useful to understand the relationship between soil formation and topography, and to land use changes, and also to organisms, because the geochemical mass balance approach has been rarely or less so applied to answer those questions. So let's first talk about topography. So here I'm going to show you a very know, small set of data from the two hill slopes in southwestern Australia. And the one is called, you know, Frog's Hollow, and the other one is Nunnan River. And the Frog's Hollow is, you know, further away from the coast, and it's on the elevated places above the escarpment. So Frog's Hollow site is, you know, drier and cooler, but the Nunnan River site, you know, being close to coast is, and also the being at the low elevation is warmer and wetter. But those two sites share all other you know, environmental variables like climate and parent material, etc. So this is the kind of hill slope from Frog's Hollow, and which is on drier and the cooler side. You're looking at the hill slope transect from the convex nose to the Pansional Hollow. So at the convex slope, which is eroding, then you have very sparse vegetation. And also because of the, you know, sparsity of the vegetation, you have the evidence of, you know, overland flow that lead to soil erosion in addition to the bioturbation by ant mound that also contribute to soil erosion. But at the Pansional Hollow, you have, you know, significantly denser vegetation, and that's where the sediments eroded from the convex slope get deposited and thicken over the time. So here is the, you know, two you know, tau profiles, which is the mass, you know, fractional mass loss or gains relative to parent material. But I want you to ignore the blue dust for now and just to focus on the red dust. And then the red dust, you know, are divided into two landscape locations, and one is the rectangles are from the convex slope, and then those round-shaped you know, symbols belong to depositional and hollows. So you can see the clearly the differences between the eroding and depositional slopes. So basically you have negative values for both phosphorus and calcium for the eroding slope, but you have the positive values for depositional hollow. So which means that you have the loss of those, you know, calcium and phosphorus over the time of soil formation on the eroding slope. But somehow you have those elements, you know, significantly enriched in the depositional hollow. And that is primarily because of, you know, rush of vegetation at the depositional slope, because that's where the moisture is less limiting for plant productivity. But let's also look at the silicon. So when you look at the silicon tau values, and you see the same thing, there is a significant loss in the eroding slope. But when you look at the depositional slope, then you have a significant enrichment of silicon. So it's hard to imagine that all of such, you know, high level of enrichment can be maintained by grass productivity. So we began to look at, you know, the particle size variation along the hill slope and also mineralogical variation along the hill slope. So upper graph on the right shows you that there is a preferential enrichment of, you know, sand particles in the depositional slope and at the expense of silt-sized materials. And when you look at the graph at the below on the right side, and there is also, you know, increasing concentration of mineral quartz toward the depositional hollow when you look at the empty the rectangular the symbols those are about the soil values. So what may happen was that, you know, because of the overland flow that is active at the Frog's Hollow, the overland flow preferentially removed, you know, sand particle sizes toward the depositional slope, and such that the enrichment of the silicon at the depositional hollow is, you know, further enhanced. So it looks like, but when you look at the Nunnan River site, which is wetter and warmer, and that's also where we have, you know, constant, you know, very homogeneous vegetation cover regardless of the landscape positions. And then now this, you know, those values from the Nunnan River are shown by the blue dust. And when you look at the blue dust, and all of those, you know, tau plots basically show not much variation regardless of the topographic positions. And that is also associated, you know, little change in the quartz concentration along the hill slope transect. So what we are running out of, you know, comparing those two sites is that, you know, those tau values and signify kind of topographic interference with the climate control on chemical weathering. And because, you know, by looking at the tau values for nutrient elements like calcium and phosphorus, and you can see that which part of the landscape is, you know, more active in terms of the biological retention of those elements. And also by looking at the tau values of the silicones and potassium that are more tied to, you know, abiotic processes, you can also think about, you know, how different erosion mechanisms that are dependent on the climate may leave the geochemical signature on those hillslopes. So now let's look, change the subject to land use. And this is the landscape from the coastal Delaware. And there is you have the forest side and the very next to, you know, crop fields. And you know, those forests have not been plowed for the more than a century, so which makes the really nice comparison between the forest that is not plowed versus agricultural plot that is, you know, currently in use for agricultural production. So let's first look at the concentration data. So here I'm showing you the concentration of phosphorus as a function of depth. You can see in the forest size, and also you can also look at the agricultural field. And as we expect, the agricultural field has a higher concentration of phosphorus. But that doesn't tell us about the kind of genesis behind of those soils. But once you calculate the fractional mass losses of phosphorus, then you learn that the phosphorus soils have negative values except at the surface of the soil, showing that about 50% of the original phosphorus has been, you know, dissolved and leached out of the soil during the soil formation. But when you look at the, you know, agricultural field, there is, you know, dramatic enrichment of phosphorus, and that is, you know, increasing toward the surface. So what this shows us is that the farmers have not only replenished what has been, you know, replenished the phosphorus that has been lost during the soil formation, but they have extra, such that now soil is, you know, tremendously enriched in the phosphorus relative to its parent material. So when you do it, do the similar analysis for other kind of inorganic nutrients, then you can begin to draw this concept. So the y-axis here is the tau values. You know, plus is obviously enrichment, and the negative values are the depletion relative to parent material. So in this case, the soil is about 100,000 years old, ultisols. And over the 100,000 years of soil formation, those phosphorus and calcium and potassium have been lost relative to the parent material. But over the last 100 to 200 years since the forest was converted to agriculture, we have not only replenished much of the loss, but also actually, you know, provided extra that now soils are enriched in those elements relative to their parent material, which leads to, you know, very unique soil that you are not going to find in the natural environment. So I'm going to give you another example how soils vary with, you know, organisms. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my study in the Minnesota. And so even though, you know, not many people recognize, and the earthworms in the glaciated part of North America are, you know, introduced species or even exotic or invasive species. And because, you know, when the glacier was in its maximum activity, it came down to, you know, virtually covering half of the North America and then disseminated the native, you know, earthworm populations. So after glacier retreated and the forest followed, but then earthworm disposal rate is so slow. So those forests and the prairies in much part of North America have evolved without, you know, earthworms over the last 10,000 years. And until the Europeans arrived with their, you know, agricultural crops that have, you know, earthworm cocoons, and until, you know, fishermen bring their earthworm, you know, base to remote lakes and forests, or until that, you know, logging activities go into the forest. So at this particular site near, you know, in the north central Minnesota, and I'm looking at the impact of invasive earthworms on forest biogeochemistry. And at this particular site, the invasive earthworms arrived with, in a fishing village, that kind of fishing recreational resort that were built in the 1950s. So you see this recreational road, and then next to it is the deciduous forest, and that is primarily made of basswood and the sugar maples. And then, you know, left side of that recreation road is the fishing village. So earthworms have been, you know, dispersing from that recreation resort into the forest. So there is a direction of the invasion, and I'm looking at about a 200 meter transect. So x-axis is the distance from the road, and first, if you look at the green data, and that's the biomass of the little layer. So first thing you recognize as an indication of earth invasion is that you lose the little layer. So you can see that closer to the road, you have the less little layer. And the dark force here is the dark is the earth biomass that tended to increase toward the road. So you have the negative relationship between earth biomass and the little layer, which shows that as earthworms get populated and their population become diverse, they get rid of the little layer quite significantly. So when you do this for several years, then you begin to realize that earthworm dispersal rate is indeed slow. In this case, it's about 5 meter per year. So if you divide the 200 meter, that you get the idea that this invasion has been going on this particular site for about 40 years. So when I talk about earthworms, and I'm not talking about one single species, they are composed of this, four distinct functional groups. And epigeic species, they only populate the little layer, but endogeic is the one that mixed a horizon. And then finally, there are anexic species that have a deep burrow, and those are actually primary fishing bait. So now if I can recast this earthworm abundance data, then you know that not only the earthworm biomass, but also the functional diversity of the earthworm increase as the time goes on, since their first introduction. So as you go to the left, which is to near the recreation road, you have more functional diversity reflected in earthworm population. So they do change the soil structure quite significantly in biogeochemistry as well. So here is the cross-section of the soils before the earthworm invasion. You have about 5 to 10 centimeters thick litter, and then below it, you have a very minimal A horizon on top of the last layer. But once you have all of those species on the site, then you basically lose the O horizon, and then at the expense of O horizon and the last layer, you have significantly expanded A horizon that is now over 10 centimeters thick. So here, let's first look at what elemental concentrations tell us. So in all of this, data show the concentration data of calcium, magnesium, phosphorus, and potassium as a function of depth. So it shows that there is a decrease of elemental concentrations with arrival of endogeic species, which are the A-horizon mixers. And that is very evident for calcium and also evident for phosphorus. But once you come to potassium, it actually shows the opposite results. With the arrival of endogeic species, elemental concentration actually increased. But once you come to magnesium, that the result is very confusing. We can't really tell how they respond to the impact of earthworm's arrival. But let's refeature this as a tau values and now normalized for zirconium. So now let's first look at the calcium values in the tau of calcium, and then x-axis is now here from 0 to 15. So the gray dots, which indicates the profile before the earthworm invasion, show like 15 values, which means that calcium is enriched in the soil relative to parent material by 15 times. So that enrichment further increase with arrival of epiendogeic species, which bring the O-horizon material into the shallow A-horizon. But that enrichment almost disappear once you have endogeic species that really accelerate the decomposition of the organic matter and the second A-horizon. Now you see that that trend is now universal regardless of the elements that you look at. And that's true for potassium, and that's also true for phosphorus, and that's also true for magnesium as well. So this normalization method bring up something you can't really appreciate by plotting the elemental concentrations and really feature how the earthworms really perturb the biogeochemistry of this forest. So even though geochemical normalization model has been primarily used for studying soils as a function of long-term soil development, as a function of time, or function of apparent material, or a function of the climate. And I would argue that, you know, this geochemical mass balance approach has a really unrealized utility in understanding soil changes at the landscape scale, and that is very pertinent to understanding the interactions between the land surface and atmosphere. And with that, I acknowledge my students and also my collaborators and the funding agencies. And thank you. Are you asking about, kind of validity of zirconium as an index element? Is that your question about?
Yeah.
Yeah. So zirconium is not necessarily the perfect tracer, because there is, report of dissolution and leaching of the zirconium. And also because zirconium is primarily in the mineral zircons, and that are often found in the silt size to fine sand size particles, but they can be moved preferentially. So on those cases, zirconium, using zirconium as an index element may cause you some trouble. But when we normalize the zirconium relative to other index elements, like titanium and niobium, and zirconium was really the best index element at Delaware site and also at the Earthsem Invasion site and also at the Australian site as well. But the Australian site was, it gave us a lot of headache because, zirconium seems to be, as I mentioned, associated with fine sand and the silt particles, but that they tended to be less mobilized than the fine sand particles when they get subjected to the overland flow erosion. Mm-hmm. So using zirconium, in relative to other types of index element seems to be very robust in all of those sites. But then, using zirconium as an index element may bring in some additional uncertainties associated with, particular way that zirconium is related to the grain sizes distribution in the soils. Yeah. So in Nunnung River site, and that's the wetter and warmer site, and at this site we believe that the erosion mechanism is very homogeneous within the sea slope, and it is primarily mediated by bioturbation by tree throws. So in those cases, the erosion doesn't necessarily involve particle size sorting. And that seems to be evidenced by our textural analysis and also our mineralogical analysis, that regardless of topographic position in Nunnung River, you have the same texture of the soils, and you also have the same composition of the minerals around the hill slope, and which lead to very homogeneous tau values around the hill slope. But when it comes to Frog's Hollow, and the situation is significantly more complicated, and primarily because of the presence of the overland flow erosion. Frog's Hollow is a drier site, but it's still, it is less, vegetated. So there are indications of the overland flow, erosion during the heavy storms, and which seem to, move the fine particles, fine sand to coarse sand grain sizes to the depositional slope. So Now that complicates the application of the zirconia normalization method because zirconia normalization, an assumption under the geochemical normalization method is that the zirconium is conserved, and the only way to really change its concentration is by its abundance is by making it dissolved and leached out. But in this case, zirconium is also physically mobile, and in a way that it is different from other elements.
Any other questions?
All right. Thank you.